Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of Eminent Teachnology. Today's episode is going to be a little bit different. We're going to replay just a little talk Rochelle and I had about a very important topic, and that topic is Star Trek Into Darkness, the second of the Star Trek remakes. This episode comes from, it predates the podcast. In that mid-2020 awful pandemic time, I was doing a little movie YouTube thing where I would just talk with people about movies, and I was lucky enough to have Rochelle as one of my first guests. And after this, Rochelle started doing her diversity chats, which have been amazing, and I'm going to link those in the episode notes, but just wanted to sort of include this episode as maybe a history of the podcast episode. So we hope you enjoy it, and hope to see everybody soon.
All right, thank you. So today for our very, very special episode of Movies with Drew, we have my friend and coworker Rochelle joining. Rochelle, I wanted to say thanks again. You are my first non-direct family member to do this with. So I was very nervous when asking you to do it, and I'm so happy that you agreed to it, and I'm looking forward to getting to have a non-work conversation with you.
I will say one thing. You are an exceptional human being. I mean, you are constantly teaching us, leading us, guiding us in ways that those who have much higher pay grades do not. So anything that you ask me to do that I can't do, I will do. And I'm happy to do this because I am a Trekkie.
That is incredibly touching. And I would like to say this exact same thing to you. Like, I've been a Duke for, I guess, like 10 years, and the bits of my career here that really stick out, I would say the biggest one is your Tech Expo presentation last year about race and diversity in technology. Is like, I don't remember any of the other Tech Expos. Like, you have like normal Tech Expo topics that are just like nerdy technical things that they're all fine, they're all great. And then there's your presentation, I guess about a year and a half ago. And it was just incredibly life-changing and thought-provoking. And it was amazing. And I was just glad to be there to be able to see it. And I'm looking forward to when you do your next one, when we all get another Tech Expo and when we're all back together and everything. So
thank you. Thank you very much.
But today we're going to talk about Star Trek. So I was very happy when, you threw out a couple movies. One was Dune and the other was Star Trek. And oddly enough, my wife had just requested doing Dune the day before. So we literally just watched the Dune movie again last week. So it's like, I'd love to talk about that, but also Star Trek, because I've been looking for an excuse to rewatch those Star Trek movies. So we're going to
watch War Games too, if you get a chance. Watch War Games. War Games is a powerful movie.
I don't think I've seen War Games since I was like, I don't even know. Like, I was taller. I was shorter than, I was a baby, I think. I was a tiny kid when that came out.
I think what War Games does is it shows the vulnerability of technology. So a simple game as tic-tac-toe can defeat the highest level of automation, which was really profound to me. So that's why I suggested that too, because if you do get a chance to watch it, you'll see it is changing to see this computer that is a supercomputer with all power, all knowing, engages itself with tic-tac-toe and learns that if you play tic-tac-toe long enough, you know you cannot win.
Interesting. So that's obviously, I never understood that aspect of it when I watched it as a kid, so I'm extra looking forward to watching it now.
Absolutely.
So talking about Star Trek, we're going to talk about Star Trek Into Darkness, which is sort of, would you call it like a remake of Wrath of Khan, or sort of like a reimagining of Wrath of Khan?
Absolutely.
What about that one really like struck home with you? What made that stick out compared to the other two Star Trek movies that came out in the remake era?
The original Captain Kirk was always adventurous, to use a pleasant term. He was always pushing forward. Mm-hmm. And he would encounter foes and somehow try to figure out how to outsmart the foes so his team could win. So the theory that the good guy always wins.
Yeah.
And so The Wrath of Khan was a pretty powerful movie. I think it came out in 86 or 87. I don't remember when it was. It was a long time ago. Uh-huh. And the man from, was it Treasure Island or Beautiful Island? I can't remember what it was. I had the little short man. But he played the role of Khan. Uh-huh.
That part of Baltimore or something. He's got a hard pronouncement name.
Yeah. But he played it so beautifully. He was such a powerful adversary for Kirk. And so when Kirk finally defeated him at such high cost, because in the Wrath of Khan, Spock dies.
Yeah.
And Spock was Kirk's right hand.
Yeah.
And so the power of that movie was so profound that they would look at this and say, let's do this now in the 20th century.
Yeah.
24th, I don't know which one it is. But again, the adversary was powerful. He was cunning. He had more skills and more strength than Kirk did, as in the Wrath of Khan. And then at the end, good triumphs over evil.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's that good triumphs over with like incredible sacrifice to the people on the good side.
Yeah, because the opposite thing was in Wrath of Khan, Kirk dies. In Star Trek Into Darkness, Spock dies. But in the Into Darkness, Kirk almost dies, but they're able to regenerate his cells using some from the being Khan.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. Like, I assumed one of them was going to die in the Into Darkness, but I was like, well, which one's it going to be? And when they flipped it, I was like, that's great. And then I was like, well, what's going to happen to Kirk? Like, are they got to do something. And I really liked how they had like a little tribble in there with Khan's blood and they put him back together. I thought that was very cool.
Yep. And it kind of strings together the entire Star Trek thing because the Tribbles, I don't know if you saw it. You said you didn't watch Star Trek episodes. There was an episode with those Tribbles. And there were a gazillion of them, and they were multiplying, every single day. And so Kirk had to figure out how to destroy them because they were wreaking havoc on the Enterprise. So it was really interesting how they still tied all that stuff still together, So that was very, very interesting.
It is a neat, I was curious what they would do. I'm sort of familiar with, the older Star Treks, but I watched The Last Generation, but I never watched the original series. So I was curious how they were going to reboot, because I didn't have a ton of interest in Star Trek, but I sort of liked I thought it was an interesting world. And the first reboot of Star Trek, that, blew my mind. And everyone since has been, they're almost perfect movies. Like, they have good arcs, all the characters are great, they're really awesome. So I was very happy to get an excuse to rewatch them.
I'd say one of the good things that has come from Star Trek, all of the series, including the current series, is how much that technology has become a reality. Because back in the 70s, when they first started, these were, high ideals and, things that we could not even conceive would be possible. Beam me up, Scotty. Who would ever have thought that would be possible? And now there are some of these technologies that were first introduced in Star Trek TV shows and movies are now becoming a part of reality.
Yeah, even just like things like cell phones and those communicators and everything. I mean, that, 30 years ago was sci-fi, and now it's just an everyday. We probably take it for granted, and a lot of those bits are probably cooler than the things that they had in those older movies.
Absolutely.
So did you watch the other Star Trek franchises as well, or are you mainly an original?
So I watched the Star Trek franchises with Picard. He reminded me a lot of Kirk, but not really any of the other ones, because they seem to get more, I don't even know what, sort of washed down or weakened from the theory of what Star Trek was about. I mean, because any Star Trek movie starts to go where no man has gone before, and so when you look at some of the other ones, it seemed like they were less in tune with that and thinking more about, innovation and how to bring different communities together that are unwilling to come together, you know, people who see each other differently. You know, I don't know if you ever watched any of the older Star Treks, but the first black and white kiss on TV was on Star Trek, where Uhura kissed Kirk, and I don't know, some things supposedly made them kiss, and there was a lot of uproar about that, you know. But it was just like, so when you look at these kind of other ones that have come along since that, you know, it's kind of like they're not the same quality of Star Trek as were the older ones in some of the movies. Some of the movies have not been good. The Voyage, the one that came after, came before Into Darkness. No, I'm sorry. It's one that came after The Search for Spock, Voyage to a New Country or something. Like, that was just absolutely I could barely watch it. I mean, like, good Lord, really? But, you know, so I think that some of the directors, and then I believe Spock died, Leonard Nimoy died a few years ago from lung cancer. And then the original creator of Star Trek, I think he died. And so those that are picking up his legacy, you know, sometimes they're holding to the same values that he did, but now it's a little different.
I was surprised to read, so in the third Star Trek film, they have Sulu's character, he has a husband, which, like, when I saw it, I was like, oh, this is great. And it's a sort of like a fitting tribute to the actor who played Sulu, right? George Takei.
Yep.
I read an interview where he said that he didn't like the choice that they made his character gay. He thought that Gene Roddenberry wouldn't have liked that. And that was sort of, I mean, I guess his opinion is important, obviously, but I don't know. That's sort of, I was saddened to hear that he didn't like the character of Sulu being a gay character, but because I thought it was a very interesting choice.
But if you think about that in just regular context, to have some kind of label attached to you after you've had such a luxurious career may deflate your value, you know, because, you know, although he was in fact gay and did have a husband, but then to have that put on Star Trek as a thing kind of, you know, may have hurt his reputation, because, like, you know, sometimes you don't hear from him anymore. You know, but I think that one of the most amazing things about Star Trek is how sometimes they're almost on point with life, you know? So whatever's going on, you'll find that there's a part where Star Trek recognizes it and highlights it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's something that is definitely not a perspective I had come at it from. And I do like how they really have, I mean, there's a true diversity on the bridge or whatever. They have white, Russian, Scottish, black, green.
Exactly. Everything you can imagine.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That was a bit, when I went back and rewatched The Wrath of Khan, that was something that was refreshing to see, is that race did not have, like, there were no, like, it wasn't a thing. It was just some people were white and some people were black, and it had.
And they worked well together.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And that was really nice to see.
Yep. I think Gene Roddenberry was ahead of his time.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. My wife and I were talking about Dune when we were watching that, and I think we were both surprised that rewatching it, there is, like, no diversity. Like, almost everyone in that was a white actor. And that was, I was sort of surprised about it. I guess you watch everything with newer eyes nowadays, but it was.
I think what Dune did, they had diversity, but they had hierarchical diversity, not skin diversity. So, right. You know, the little woman who saved the young fellow's life, or gave him the, you know, tell him he had a betrayal in his thing, you know, the father dying, you know, I mean, talked a little bit about, you know, class in a society, you know, like, so the woman he had the children with were not at his level, you know, and so things like that, you know, and then the properties that the wife had, you know, where she could sense or understand what people were thinking, was amazing. But if you think about the worms, if you think about the people who came and talked to the whoever, the governor, whatever you want to call the opposite side, you know, they were more animal-like than they were people-like, you know. And so there was parts of that really did hit me, that although you didn't see any black faces, you understood that they were still attempting to address diversity. Now, I will say one thing about Dune, you know, so the good triumphs over evil, you know, you saw that, and you could see there that was coming. But, you know, Picard was in that movie. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh,
you
saw
that. But
he also looks exactly the same now as he did then. I want some of his genes.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. But I think some of the most incredible things about Dune is just the thought. If we really watched it, you know, intellectually, you see that killing the worms is what gave the group that was in power power, was by killing the worms. Mm-hmm. And so as a young fella goes through and becomes, you know, more powerful and gains more, you know, you could see his empathy for things that were not like him, if you will, you know. Yeah. So you could see, yeah, that, you know. So I think that there was that, you know, and I do think that they did make a good example of the haves and the have-nots. So the people that were living in the caves with water that eventually became his allies is example of diversity of a different kind, just class, not necessarily skin, if right. That makes sense.
That absolutely does. That's, as always, these are all amazing points that totally went over my head. One other thing that I liked about the Into Darkness was it sort of starts off with Kirk's rage at his father figure being killed, and then it circles back around and has Spock raging about Kirk's death. But I really like how, you know, they start from this emotional, you know, I'm ready to tear the world down to avenge my friend, and then they land on the side of justice, and, you know, right. Kirk decides not to blow away that planet. He decides to do the right thing and capture Khan, and then Spock has to save Khan because he needs to save his friend, but it all comes back. It's just I like movies that have that sort of turn of, you know, yes, yeah, I'm raging, but when it comes down to it, I'm going to do the right thing. And I thought this movie did it really well.
I think so too. I mean, you know, when you sent me the Teams thing, you know, I thought about that, and I could have told you a lot of movies. So you remember Harold the Computer? You know, Hal came out. What did Hal? I mean, there were so many I could have suggested, and as I told you, I read more about and watch more historical documentaries as opposed to fiction and nonfiction. The only nonfiction I read is Grisham. And Star Trek is probably the only fiction TV I watch, you know. And so at times I find myself struggling to break through what I'm watching. So I don't watch TV just for the purpose of watching TV. I watch TV to see if I can learn something. Is there something there for me there? Uh-huh. And if it's not, I immediately stop watching it. And so if you take John Grisham, for example, I have every book he's ever written. And I've read every last one of them. And I keep them in a special collection because I think his stories about injustice are really powerful. And they actually emulate life, you know. Yeah. So, you know, whether you read A Time to Kill or what's the other good one? The Litigators or whatever it is, you actually see these things happening in real life. These are really, you know, things that happen. Where, for example, I can't remember which one it is, but there's one where these students are amassing massive student loan debts to go to school. And there's this fact, the school that is really a law school factory, that's just churning out lawyers that have very little skills. And at the end, they owe gazillions of dollars. Yeah. And the student that was most disabled by it and broke through what was going on there then became a part of the solution, although he did end up losing his life. You know, I think that there are just, you know, I think sometimes when you look at TV, like the TV that I watch most, our family calls murder TV, and it's just like television shows where people are being killed by family members for the three obvious reasons, love, money, or jealousy, you know, those kinds of things. And so what I look for is not, I already know, almost as soon as the movie starts, you can tell who's going to be the bad guy in the movie. But what's in there is dissecting the psychology of action. So why do we do what we do? And so if we go back to Star Trek and Into Darkness, Khan did not have humanity. He did not, he only cared about those torpedoes because they were like him and I guess something like that. And so he cared about them, but that was the only humanity that he had. And so as you look at Star Trek Into Darkness and you start to dissect pieces and parts of it, so Kirk, Spock, Uhura, you know, Scotty, all each one of these people make significant contributions to the success of capturing and refreezing Khan.
Right.
But what really it leads you to think, one of these days, those popsicles are going to all be unfrozen. And what will it mean then? You know, so when we have a new Kirk, when we have a new Spock, what will it mean, you know, when these people who are superhumans come to life? And so if you translate that into current life, the 1% of the wealthiest people in the world are almost invisible to the 99% of us. You know who they are, but they don't contribute to their societies. You know, they may have philanthropic activities, but they really don't look far enough down into humanity to see the problems that are going on. So you could have a place like Flint, Michigan, not have clean water. Or you could have places where black men and women are being killed all over the South. You know, you can have, you know, people who are unable to pay their bills and, you know, whatever the situation is, you know, Star Trek kind of does that deep down look. So if you take Khan could be the 1%, him and those other people in those frozen torpedoes.
Yeah.
They are the 1%. They're super people. And what the 99% does is it puts them to sleep so they can survive. But at some point, they're going to have to wake up. And then, but what really will happen? So when the 1% really is fully in charge of the world, what happens to the 99%?
Yeah, not good if it's any indication of just what the one Khan could do. There's 72 or however many more that are just waiting to be opened up. That's a scary thought.
Yep. And to further that, you know, those 1%ers could get rid of hunger in the snap of a finger.
Yeah.
They could get rid of this difference between the haves and the have-nots with just one finger and never touch any of their real money.
Yeah.
But there's a reason why they want this to exist. And in Star Trek, there's a reason why Khan has to exist. There's a reason why there has to be adversaries and protagonists and antagonists in a movie, because it's necessary to teach us something. The question is, do we get it or do we continue to keep doing it over and over and over again, as in The Wrath of Khan and The Into Darkness, which is repeating it over and over and over again. The message is saying the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It absolutely does. It's a scary and sad fact of life right now.
Yep.
The John Grisham thing was interesting. So you work for you're the IT manager. Is that your official position, IT manager at the law school?
Officially, my title is senior manager, IT. My actual manager is manager of infrastructure and user support.
Nice. So
I don't get paid for those titles, though.
That's awful as well. So the John Grisham thing I thought was interesting because he's obviously very into law. And is your interest in law something that got you interested in working for the law school at Duke, or were those just sort of happy coincidences?
I thought I told you this before, but I thought I did, but I didn't. So the law school in 2008 had failed an audit. The current person that was in charge of the law school had somehow or another let students' emails going to the public domain.
Yes, I remember this now.
Scooter Freeney, who was your IT director at the time, called me up one day. I was working for Durham Public School, and he called me up one day and he says, "Rochelle, the law school has failed an audit and they need your help." Now, you know, at that time, you know, pranking people was something that was happening all the time, because I thought somebody was just pranking, so I just hung up the phone, you know. He calls right back and he says, "Rochelle, somehow we got disconnected." I didn't tell him, I hung up on him. But he called right back and he says, "You know, there are two people I'd like you to talk to as soon as you possibly can." He gave me Wayne's name and Dick Danner, who was Wayne's boss at the time. At the time of the audit failure, they had started to reorganize what we now call Academic Technologies, which is our group. And Wayne became the director of IT in the law school. He moved from media to director of IT.
Okay.
And so when I met with him and Dick, they said, "You know, we need your help. You know, this is just a temporary thing. We're going to pay you X amount of dollars and buy." Well, when that period had passed, by January, I guess I'd made myself some sort of valuable, because they hired me on June 1st, 2009. So started contracting in July of 2008, and then became permanent on January 1st of 2009. And
nice.
So the interesting thing about law, especially being a woman of color, is that it's so, I don't even know what the word is. It's subjective. That's it. The word is subjective. So if you get pulled over by a police officer, you were doing 65 and a 35, If you have a good lawyer, you can get that changed to, you know, you were doing 35 and a 35.
Yeah. You know, and that's if they don't just let you off with a warning or let, like,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
OJ Simpson is another example of looking at the law. Whenever you hear, you talk to lawyers, they always tell you the rule of law. And the rule of law says law must do what law must do, and it must follow these steps. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's the mantra, but the actual action varies depending on how much money you have, who you know, how can you contact someone to get help or whatever. And that is what has been my greatest joy about working in law school, and specifically with Black judges and lawyers and faculty, because, you know, I think you know this, every year I have two big dinners at my house. I invite any Duke student, whether a Duke law student, wherever they're at Duke, I invite a bunch of faculty, you know, staff and other people to come to talk to these students, because, you know, these are young people still finding their way, and there are people who are adults who've been there and done that. So they all get together. And, you know, if you read in my thing, I told you about what Dan Bruno did. I mean, like, there are people like that that are just so phenomenal and help these kids get on their feet. Kenny Lewis graduated from Harvard Law, and I think he went to Duke undergrad. He's a Black lawyer here in the area. And he came and talked to our students one day. We set it up so he could have a podium and all that stuff. And the students were mesmerized by what he had to tell them about his journey. Yeah, you know, Judge Webster did the same thing. And, you know, they're always, always thinking about, you know, how do we get people that look like us in the domain? So the number of Black and brown law students that are partners that lead law firms are very, very, very small, just like in IT. Know very yeah. very small. So that's what really you know, has stuck with me working in the law school. But really, I read everything I can about it. You know, I read about, you know, the law, because, like I said, you know, so if the law clearly states, which is the rule of law, that the speed on the highway is 35 miles an hour, according to their dictum, there should be no exception. Right. 35 miles an hour, if you're doing 45 or 55, whatever it is, you should not have resources or anyone who's going to go in there and argue and drill your charges down to something that's going to end up you paying a fee and going home to your family. You know, that's the conflict I have with law, that the law is so subjective to money, power, you know, whatever. So,
yeah. And with all the, I mean, I guess the big word now is like the systematic racism that is like everywhere, that only makes it worse for non-white people, which keeps the cycle going and going and going. And just
last year we had several incidences with Black students, even brown students, last year at the law school, the class of 2019, that were just so heartbreaking, you just couldn't even imagine, and you felt almost helpless to help them, you know. And I mean, like, what I have been able to do is use the connections I've made to help who I can help, you know. And, you know, for someone who really came from nowhere, I mean, I was extremely poor as a child. You know, my mom that raised me was my paternal aunt.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep. She had a fourth grade education. She had been in the South all of her life, and she was a domestic. And she would always say the three things to me: Rochelle, get a good education, get out of South Carolina, and get a good job. And, when I was young, I used to think she was just a monster, because, I mean, she didn't know how to show love. She wasn't kind. You know, she combed my hair. She tried to pull my head off my shoulders. And she just was not nice. And as I've gotten older, I've learned that my mother was trying to keep me alive. You know, she knew in the part of South Carolina where we were, Black people died or disappeared, you know, just like that for a little
nothing. Where in South Carolina did you grow up?
About 27 miles from Charleston, in a town called Walterboro, South Carolina.
Okay.
Yeah. And so as I am who I am today, I'm an advocate, you know. I mean, I think you know, I write to your managers, I write to almost everybody that's in Texan Collab's manager and tell them what a great job they've done. You know, tell them how much they matter. Because what mostly happens in our conversations, we hear what they've done wrong. We hear what our staff's done wrong, or when something has gone askew. You know, and so in a lot of ways, my thoughts are, how do we advocate for each other? So would you pick up the phone and call Tracy or someone you know at Cisco and say, hey, hire Rochelle. I know she's really, really great. That's something that we as a society have not learned. And that's advocacy for each other. You know, making sure the person, like, so if there's a chance that you're going to get an exceptional on your PEP, let me help you get there. Let me write to your supervisor and tell him, hey, you know, Drew is phenomenal. He's done all these wonderful things. You know, he's an exceptional employee. Hopefully that gets some benefit to you. But I think it's really important that we advocate for each other and that we become together. In other words, lockstep together in our work. You know, the reason why I formed Texan Collab was because I had taken a job that I hadn't done in 25 years. I had not been a systems infrastructure or project manager in over 25 years. And my colleague leaves, and I really am given an ultimatum, either take this job or we're going to let you go. Okay. So I took the job. And so there were lots of areas where I had no understanding whatsoever because it had changed from when I was in that job, when I was in my early 20s and late 30s. Yeah. To
and
what
technology
it was.
Moves so fast just in a normal pace, like that's
exactly. And so you guys becoming a team with me became the strength to help me do my job and to provide the intelligence and intellect to help me think about how to do my job and be successful in my job. And I could tell you almost every single member of Texan Collab, if I call and ask them, even if I call them asking what time of the day it is, they almost all respond. They all give me context and help me get through this, you know. And so, and I think very few are like you, though, Drew. I mean, no disrespect to any of the rest of them because they are absolutely phenomenal. But you reach out and say, hey, what can we teach you all today? And I don't think people realize how valuable that is because adding new tools to your tool bag helps you with whatever your next step may be.
Oh, yeah,
and the fact that you bring people over to talk about OpenShift or you bring people in to talk about web service or whatever it is, it's just a phenomenal identification with your character of who you are.
Well, that I really appreciate you saying that, Rochelle. That's very nice of you. And the other side of that, I think a lot of times we as like technical people get very like heads down and don't want to talk to anybody. And we have all these sort of cool things, but you know, being sort of an introverted group, it's hard for people to get out and like show that off, even if it's like something that can help other people. So it's, this has been another one of my favorite parts of the job is being able to come over and hang out with y'all and talk about things. And even if it's not something I know about, at least bringing somebody that does know something neat, it's always interesting. And the rest of the Texan Collab group, like you've really assembled a great group of awesome people. Like every single one of them is both a really nice like person in general and also really good at their jobs. So it's very
absolutely. We are grateful for them. We're grateful for each one of them. You know, sometimes it's disheartening when they don't come up to lunch, especially now that we can do lunch in Zoom. We ain't got to drive someplace, you know, and find a parking place in Durham. But you know, that's kind of sad. But you know, some of us are true introverts, and so you know, being with people and having to talk and all stuff, you know, not something that's our cup of tea.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that we're probably at about a time here. So I just want to say thanks again, and I'm going to stop recording real fast.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.